Welcome, everybody, to a new week of Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. So, Avi, do you curse?
I'll come clean. I'll come clean. I curse quite a bit. I do. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm known to add a little flavor to the language.
Who curses more?
I don't know. Like, and I use different, I told you, I use a different code in the office. So I typically try to refrain from using flagrant foul language in the office.
And
but
you noted that your voice carries more than mine.
It does.
So you really have to be a lot more careful.
Yeah, exactly.
Than I do.
Exactly. And so we're going to talk today about cussing, cursing, swear words, and talk a little bit about why we curse and why certain words are so taboo. We have the author of the book, What the F, who's going to be talking to us, Mr. Benjamin Bergen. So I'm looking forward to that conversation because it's levels to it. It's a lot of depth to this.
There is. And it reflects the way we use language and what we consider off limits in our society and how that target is always changing. And I would just be very interested to hear from our listeners where their line is. Like, what are the words you won't say in private company, around your kids? Like, are there hard no's for you? Are you just letting it fly in mixed company? Like, I'm very curious how people use language.
Or is it just for emphasis or to make a story a little bit more colorful?
Right.
You know what I mean?
And so, then also, like, what do you think cursing is becoming more prevalent in society? And
have
if so, where do you
far?
See that?
Yeah.
So give us a call. A clean call.
Yes.
Because we will use euphemisms and fill in words in this show. We are on the air live, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org and let us do the editing for you.
Exactly. And today we will get to NPR Weekend Edition host, my interview with Aisha Roscoe, who's talking about why HBCUs are still so relevant. She edited a book with a whole bunch of famous folks who went to HBCU. So I'm looking forward to hearing that interview.
And we are going to play that
interview.
We're going
to get to it. I know. We had so much discussion.
I don't care how good this cursing conversation is. We are going to get to that interview. But first, we're going to head down the shore. And it was a beautiful, long holiday weekend at the shore for many, many people. However, in Ocean City and Wildwood, things got a little out of hand. In Ocean City, a teenager was stabbed, and Wildwood had to declare a state of emergency because so many unruly crowds of young people gathered on the boardwalk. Joining us to talk about all of this now is WHYY's Tom McDonald, who was down the shore over the weekend. Tom, thanks for hopping on the line.
Good afternoon.
So, Tom, let's dig in. What exactly happened? And I want you to start in Wildwood and then in Ocean City. What went on?
Well, Wildwood was a declaration of a state of emergency Sunday night, where they closed down the boardwalk because of what they called civil unrest. And they didn't get very definitive about that. Through the enactment of a state of emergency, which included closure of the boardwalk, the city of Wildwood was able to effectively address numerous incidents of civil unrest to, what they say, ensure the safety and welfare of our residents and visitors. And that was where I talked to Mayor Troiano for a few seconds yesterday morning, and the man who's normally very outgoing was very not outgoing. He said, we're working on it, and they issued a long statement, which we have on our website, whyy.org.
And then Ocean City, Tom, what can you tell us about what happened there?
Ocean City was Saturday night. Now, everybody is more thinking Ocean City is the conservative family resort. I mean, they build themselves as America's greatest family resort. Now, they had a group of unruly teens on the boardwalk, and eyewitnesses say there were a number of little skirmishes that broke out, and one teenager got stabbed. Now, we don't know how serious this stabbing is, because nobody's willing to tell us how serious it was. It's just being said to be non-life-threatening injuries.
Wow, and I saw a video of teens running off the boardwalk in Ocean City, and the mayor there has said, if you don't want to behave, don't come. What has been the response, the reaction from the business community, from the residents to these situations?
I think this has sent a little bit of a scare into America's greatest family resort, because people are normally feeling calm, relaxed. It's a big family island that people want to go there for its calmness, as opposed to I won't upset the mayor of Wildwood. It's always been called Childwood, and everybody knows that when you go to Wildwood, it's a lot more rowdy down there. I mean, it's a younger crowd. It's a little more, let's say, unrehearsed, uncontrolled crowd.
Well, I know you know the shore so well, Tom. I mean, how unusual do you think this is for an opening weekend? Because, look, opening weekend, a lot of people are charged up, I would imagine. Have you seen anything like this before, or does this feel like really out of character?
You know, this is the perfect non-storm, except for Monday, of weather. The spring was very, very rainy almost every weekend in the spring. So people who had second houses just didn't come down the shore. There was a lot of pent-up frustration. The beaches were great on Saturday. People were enjoying the shore. But Saturday night, things just got out of hand. Now, over the last, say, 4 years, New Jersey has had a juvenile justice reform effort that has not sat well with these beach towns. I mean, look, I'm an older guy. When I was growing up, it was not very hard to wind up in jail in Wildwood. And now it's very difficult because there are multiple things that have to be done before any sort of charges can be done. There has to be a curbside warning, a station house adjustment, a use of complaint summonses in lieu of complaint warrants, and then a presumption against pretrial juvenile detention. And the teens know this.
Yeah.
So they push things to the limit. Last year in Ocean City, the police diverted all the kids out onto the beach, and there was smoking marijuana, drinking, and all that stuff. This year, they tried to take a little more of a hard stance, and it's back to the drawing board.
And quickly, as we wrap up, Tom, I mean, we talked about the new rules at the shore, from curfews to backpack bans. Will there be more to come as a crackdown in response to this? Do you anticipate that?
The question is what the shore towns can do legally when Trenton is telling them not to be rough with the teens.
We will keep following this, and I know you will, Tom. That's Tom McDonald from WHYY News. Really appreciate the time on this Tuesday.
Thank you.
Let's get into some more headlines now, Cherry. Mm-hmm. And here's a feature that caught our eye in the Inquirer about the warehouse boom in the greater Philadelphia area. Let's start with a stat. In 2020, there were 24 warehouses in our region, 20,000 square feet or larger, 24 total in 2020. By 2025, we anticipate there will be 189
wow.
over a five-year period. And of course, this is all attributable, mostly attributable, to the boom in e-commerce. All of these e-commerce giants and companies need lots of warehouses to keep all these products so they can get them to your door super, super, super fast. And it's really changing the landscape of our region. So I thought this was a fascinating deep dive that you can read at the Inquirer, just looking at where all of these warehouses are popping up and how they're changing communities because they have a huge footprint.
Yeah, and it'll talk about jobs. It'll bring jobs to those communities. Really cool feature by the Inky. I thought about when I lived in Delaware, how Delaware was sort of becoming this warehouse place. Burlington County.
South Jersey. There's a
South
lot
Jersey.
In South Jersey.
Yeah, and now even in Philly, you know, with the Bellwether District trying to set itself apart as a warehouse spot. So interesting feature. Lots to come. By the way, my cell phone case broke or got damaged. I placed an order on Amazon this morning and it'll be at the house by the time I get home. Why? Because
Amazing.
A warehouse is nearby.
And it's really, it's totally transforming the landscape and the economy. And one thing that this story made me think about is you see all the old factories in the city around the region and you're wondering, why did the factories end up in these places? Why were they all in Kensington and River Wards area? And a lot of it is it's infrastructure and geography, maybe being near a railroad track or a river. And for these warehouses, one of the things that they really dove into with this story is that they're clustered around big highways because you can hop right on the highway and get that product to someone's front door really, really fast.
In just hours.
And so infrastructure drives so much of just like where the jobs are and how our whole region looks. And this is just one example of it. And it just made me think about some historical parallels. So I was really sucked in by this.
Yeah.
So good job, Inquirer.
Yeah,
well done.
Good job. And, you know, our expectations are going to be changing now that, you know, we can get things so quickly.
We want it now.
We want it now. So another thing we kind of want now.
But it's not happening now.
What is going on is a $2 billion development on Penn's Landing. It has stalled. The project, which is located between Vine and Callow Hill Streets on Christopher Columbus Boulevard, it broke ground in the fall of 2022 with the promise that it'd bring thousands of residential units, offices, retail space, and a hotel. But after that groundbreaking, Avi, all the work kind of stopped. And the developer in question is the New York-based Durst organization. They're apparently still negotiating the plans, and they have not hashed out a final agreement to move the project forward with the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation. That's the nonprofit that owns the land. And this is a pretty big deal. I don't know if you've driven down Columbus Boulevard lately, but I mean, the construction is booming. Lots coming. We got, all sorts of new housing development. We talked about the I-95 CAP project.
Yep.
I mean, the waterfront is having a moment. And folks are wondering what is happening with this big development. But I will say the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation, they say that they still want to work with this developer.
So. Yeah, so you mentioned the I-95 cap.
Yeah.
That's a big part of this. So they're capping part of I-95 to connect the waterfront to the rest of Old City and thus the rest of Center City, right? So it's sort of walkable, and it's a neighborhood. And they're trying to build out this neighborhood. And this was a huge, contentious plot of land. This Durst organization said they're going to build 12 towers, $2.2 billion development, office, residential, commercial. And now we don't know if it's going to happen. And I'll remind you, this is the plot of land that the Sixers originally wanted to build their arena on.
That is true.
And the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation said, sorry, Sixers, we're going to go with this Durst proposal. Mm-hmm. And now we're wondering if the Durst proposal is going to happen. And on the other hand, we've got this huge fight in the Market East Chinatown area over the backup plan for the Sixers. So it makes you wonder, could all of this have been avoided if they just greenlighted the Sixers proposal at the very beginning? Because that proposal would not have upended an existing neighborhood. This is a neighborhood that's kind of being redeveloped already. So
it just
makes you do a lot of sort of looking in your rear view.
Lots of questions about this.
And speaking of driving in your rear view mirror, very quickly before we get out of here, very interesting item that we caught in USA Today. The number of 16-year-old drivers who have their driver's license has been in steep decline since the 1980s. And in fact, Gen Z, people under 24, only 12% of them have a driver's license. That number has really been in free fall. And it shows you that driving really isn't the symbol of independence, and it's not the rite of passage that perhaps it was for future generations.
Yeah, I mean, Avi, we talked about this earlier. When I was 15 and 9 months, I couldn't wait to run down there and get my permit. And I was not the best driver, but thank goodness, you know, Easy Method Driving School taught me a little something. But now you have the young people, you have to push them. They don't want to do it. And a big part of it is, you know, car culture is changing. Also, ride sharing.
You have access.
People live in cities now when they're young, and they don't feel like they need cars.
And so, think about it too. If one of the big reasons you wanted a license was to go visit your friends, but if your friend culture is online,
then why do you need a car?
Why do you need a car, right? And I'm curious how this is going to change our. If this holds, this pattern holds, it could change our whole relationship to car culture, which is really embedded in American culture. So too, by the way, is swearing. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next segment, Cherry.
Yes. Are we using more profanity these days? And why do some words, right, just slip off our tongues? We'll be right back. And we want to hear from you. The number 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You probably know there are certain words considered too obscene to say on air. A handful of curse words that have to be bleeped out or presented with an advisory before they air, or a station can face a fine from the FCC. You can probably guess what most of those words are.
And as you know, we're a live show. And a few months ago, a guest got caught up in the moment and let one of those words slip out of their mouth. They apologized after, but it made us realize that for a lot of people, certain curse or cuss words are just part of normal speech. Nowadays, swear words are everywhere in pop culture. They're in casual conversation, in politics, and at work. The F-bomb, well, it really isn't such a bomb anymore.
So are we cursing more than we used to? Mm. Are norms around bad language changing? And I'm interested in this one. Why does it feel so good to swear like a sailor sometimes? We've invited cognitive scientist Ben Bergen on to answer all of our questions around these taboo words. He's been studying our brains and obscenities for a while and has a book about it called What the F? Ben Bergen, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much.
And listeners, do you think people are cursing more? Do you swear at home, at work, in front of the kids? What do you tell your kids about cursing? And are there certain words you won't say? Email us your thoughts, studio2@whyy.org, or give us a call, 888-477-9499.
And so, Ben, I mean, words considered profane or offensive have shifted over time. So I want you to kind of lay the ground rules. What makes a word offensive or to be considered a swear word?
Yeah, well, in English and in languages around the world, we find that the words that become profane have their origins, most typically, in describing human experiences that are themselves taboo. So you can think about the things that we might not discuss in polite company that would include bodily functions, interactions between adults that we might not want to describe around kids, as well as religious topics, and then finally groups of other people that we have taboos about. And those different domains of experience tend to transfer our taboos from the world to the words that describe those things. And so in English, our strongest taboo words tend to describe other groups of people in a derogatory way, or bodily functions or sex.
And then there's also something about the construction of the word itself, the way it sounds, that does seem to contribute to whether or not it's likely to become a curse word, or at least to be popular as a curse word. And I saw that you did a study where participants rated the made-up word scoom as more profane than the made-up word scoo. So what's going on there? How do like the way words sound contribute to their potential profanity?
Well, that's right. At least in English, we tend to think of words that have a particular sound structure that are one syllable long and that have lots of consonants, especially consonants at the end, and especially, not like scoom, but especially cuz and puz and tuz, those strong popping stop consonants at the end. We tend to think of those as being more likely to be profane. And that's probably just because of the history of a few very strong taboo words that we've had for hundreds of years in English that sounded that way. We've probably just thought of that as the sound of a taboo word, and new words that we invent, and when we reinterpret old words as taboo, we tend to gravitate towards words that sound that way.
So that's not a fixed thing. That's actually a reflection of past uses of other words. So in some ways, it's arbitrary.
It seems to be pretty arbitrary, just in that other languages don't work this way. If it were something sort of universal about our experience of how we use our mouths to produce language, or how we use taboo language, then you'd expect to find that across the world's languages. But it's actually quite rare.
Interesting. I want to bring in a clip because there's, when we talk about the sounds of these swear words, it's from The Good Place. Take a listen.
Get the fork out of my neighborhood.
But I say we leave this miserable shirt hole.
You know I'm trying to say ash hole and not ash hole, right?
I got that, yes.
What the fork is a cheaty?
Yeah, it'll fork you up.
Girl, you are a messy bench who loves drama and I am into it.
What a little bench! And all three of us are royally forking forked.
Just shoot the shirt with your old pal Eleanor.
I'll be soaring through the air like a forking bird.
Yeah, but I forking nailed it.
Sugar, honey, iced tea. That was a lot of language there. I want you to react to that clip and just sort of the linguistic, my mind just, all that made my mind go blank, but just sort of the linguistical issues that are there with people using words that you kind of know what they mean, but they're using safe words to sort of suggest swear words.
Yeah, those are what linguists would call minced oaths. They're words that sound a lot like words that you're trying to avoid. Usually they start with and oftentimes end with the same sounds, but may have different sounds in the middle. And yeah, they're used to to sort of negotiate a fine line where you want to let other people know what words you're trying to say, but still acknowledge that it may not be acceptable in a certain circumstance, for example, when there are censors watching.
And my follow-up to that is, when is it okay, like, you know, to use swear words? And are there situations where using a swear word is totally appropriate?
Well, I think acceptability changes over time, and it changes across cultures. There are places in the world where they don't bleep television in the same way that we do, where you would use strong words around kids sort of openly. In our current culture, we have a little bit of hesitation about those things. And the places where there's the most apprehension about using profanity tend to be in formal situations and in situations around kids. So formal, historically, that would be at the workplace, depending on the workplace. If it's sort of front of the house, facing clients, that might be a more formal scenario than back of the house, in the kitchen, that sort of thing. Similarly, around people who are of higher status or higher power, those could be bosses, those could be religious authorities, that sort of thing. Those tend to be more formal situations where it's less likely that a person will use profanity. But of course, as you said at the beginning of the segment, those windows are kind of shifting. We're seeing a lot more profanity, for example, in the workplace, in social discourse, and so on.
Yeah, let's talk about those shifting windows, because Brian says we Americans in particular cuss too much. I'm sure this is hard to totally quantify, but are we cursing more, or is it just that the situations in which it's acceptable to curse are changing? Like, what do we know about the prevalence of curse words in mixed company?
Yeah, there have been a variety of studies that have tried to track people's casual use of profanity, like in real life, in interactions, and that have found things like people tend to swear more in gender-matched scenarios, especially among close personal acquaintances and friends, than in other sorts of situations. But, you know, of course, we can't go into people's houses and with microphones and really quantify those things regularly. What we can see is what happens in social media, on the internet, and there it's pretty clear that there's been an increase over the last, say, 10 years in the prevalence of profane language. That's been pretty well documented in a variety of studies. It also shows up more in media. So I don't know what WHYY's policies are. I guess you're probably always trying to second guess what the FCC is going to say, and maybe you have an in-house a book that tells you which words are permissible when. But I think that a lot of media companies have changed. So the New York Times, for example, now will regularly publish profanity as long as it's in a quote. And that didn't always used to be the case. So I think in all cases, public media, social use of language has been shifting. And you know, that's probably at least in part due to the increased democratization of public discourse.
Can you explain that? Because get into the why a little bit there, because I'm sure some readers of the New York Times, if you could take someone from 30, 40 years ago and transport them to the present, they would be shocked at some of those quotes in the paper of record. I mean, what explains that shift?
Well, in the New York Times case, the stated reason is that if they believe that the actual words that the person used are newsworthy themselves, right? The fact of talking in a particular way may affect the reader's judgment about the appropriateness of what they said, or the judgment of what they should take away from it. I think that more broadly, 20 years ago, in order for millions of people to hear what you said, you had to have some sort of pulpit. You had to have a microphone and a production company and mm-hmm. broadcasting rights. And nowadays, obviously, that's not true with social media. And so we're getting uncensored, unfettered access to people's informal language. And informal language has always, like we were saying earlier, tended to be more infused with profanity than formal public discourse has been. And so we're seeing that shift from what used to be personal and private and informal now into the public sphere.
So fewer gatekeepers in a sense.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to read a couple of comments. Anita emails, I survived my whole life without swearing. I'm 62 years old. She says, I feel there is no reason to add those words. There are many other words you can use to emphasize what you want to say. On the other hand, Len emails, I am a prolific swearer, and my teenage son is as well. As a parent, my rules for my child in regard to swearing are simple. Only in appropriate situations, i.e. not at school, in front of strangers, etc., and absolutely no words that are aimed at hurting a specific person or group of people. We sort of talked about some of the shifting norms. And one of the things that has sort of shifted has been the use of slurs. 30, 40 years ago, people used it in regular conversation. You could see it on television and in movies. And now there is this total, abhorrence of these slurs. Sort of where does the shift come from? And when can you sort of start seeing the shift happen?
Yeah, you're exactly right. If you think about, let's say 50 years ago, George Carlin's 7 words that you can't say on television, none of those are slurs. Mm-hmm. they're the F word and the S word. And nowadays, so I run a little survey every year with about 100 undergrads just to see where, take the temperature of what they think about profanity. And just to give you a sense, the top 10 words of those top 10 most offensive words to them personally, 9 are slurs. And the F word is number 25 on the list. So this shift is active. It's happening. I think that it started to happen already in the aughts. And we know that because there's some survey data from back then showing that these sort of body-based and sex-based profanities have started to move down the list, down into the tens. It seems to be part of a cultural shift where people's attitudes towards language, I think, largely comes from people's early childhood experiences in schools, which have intentionally directed kids' attention to the possible negative effects of using derogatory terms, slurs, and so on. I think that that has become internalized by a generation of young people who are now themselves starting to have families of their own. And it's caused a huge shift in the sense that where maybe in the middle and end of the last century, it was adults policing kids' language. Nowadays, it's kids policing adults' language. Mm. That change comes from a good place, right? It's an intention to, as the caller said, it's an intention to not cause harm to other people. I think that that's always something that we can value in a society. And targeting those words specifically usually has benefits to the targeted groups, right? Because the words that we find most offensive, those slurs, they're usually targeting groups of people who themselves don't have the power to regulate language around them, right? We don't see a ton of super offensive slurs for rich white males, for example. I mean, there are some terms that are derogatory towards those people, but they certainly aren't judged to be as offensive as words that are, that are targeting historically groups who've historically had less power. So I think, I think it's coming from a good and an interesting place. And I think that the shift away from just arbitrary judgments about profanity, saying, well, this word is bad because I was taught that it's bad, or this word
it's
is
more
bad
rooted
because
in a value, really, yeah. As opposed to
exactly. Mm-hmm.
Right. That's right. Ben Bergen, professor of cognitive science at the University of San Diego and author of the book, What the F? What Swearing Reveals About Our Language, Our Brains, and Ourselves. We're talking about cursing. Email us, studio2@whyy.org. A comment here from Susan, who says she only curses at Philly potholes and when no one else is in the car. I think I've been there, Susan.
I've done that as
but
well.
But the question that brings to mind for me, Ben, is what is the psychological impact of swearing? Is it a release? Does it make us feel better? Does it make us feel worse? What do we know about kind of like the feedback loop in our brains when we let an F-bomb out?
Yes. So we can measure this, right? We can put electrodes on skin and so on, and we can measure how people react. When you swear, it increases your heart rate, your blood pressure. You start sweating. Your pupils dilate. Blood flows to your extremities. And there are a bunch of consequences of this. One is that you can tolerate pain better. Ah. It has a hypoalgesic effect such that you're able to, for example, in experiments, if you have people stick their hands in ice water, they can hold it in for about 50% longer if they're swearing than if they're saying some neutral control word like chair. we know that it makes you stronger. So if you measure a person's grip strength or how fast they can go on an inclined treadmill, you find an increase in about 5% of strength.
Wait. So when someone's running, like I would run better if I was like muttering curse words to myself?
Well, you'd have to work out the breathing pattern too. but that's right. All things being equal compared to a control word, yes, that's true.
I think about people who rarely use swear language, and I think about my mom, and one of our producers, Debbie Builder, talked about her mom as well, who never uses swear language, and then one day they do, and everybody stops because the emphasis on the fact that this person never uses foul language, and then when they do, it's like a moment, because swear words can be used for emphasis, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that... They have an emotional impact, right? So the saying of them induces this physiological effect, but also the hearing of them has an emotional impact on people. People remember swear words better than they remember other words that people have said. But of course, as you say, you can become inured to them. If you use them too much or hear them too much, they stop having their impact.
And
right?
quick.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say this shows up in the experiments, too. So you don't get the same pain-relieving effect if you're an inveterate swearer.
Oh.
It only works for people who only swear occasionally.
Okay. Good note. I want to ask you, because those were both of our moms. And we had someone write in who says that they hate hearing women cuss too much, that they find it unattractive and unappealing. This is from Brian. I want your thoughts on the gendering of sort of use of swear words. Is there a double standard there? Have you found that?
Lots of studies have shown that there are gender preferences for the use of profanity, that people who use profanity are judged differently as a function of their gender. It's true that in general, there's a belief that you were describing, that profanity tends to be judged less gender appropriate for people who identify as female, and it's therefore avoided oftentimes by women in mixed gender settings. That's possibly starting to change. We have some evidence that that the sort of balance is evening out in terms of people's biases about gender use and different genders' use of profanity. And there are particular words that women in particular have been taking over. I won't say them on the air, that they've been taking over that are historically terms that are derogatory towards women, that they've been reappropriating and taking over to give them a different kind of power.
Yeah, flipping the meaning in a sense. Another form of judgment sometimes is that parents will get judged for the language that their kids use. And Hiddard comments, "We let our kids curse at home, but not at each other. Also, my daughter needed speech therapy, and saying the F word helped her with the F sound." That's interesting. Mm. Matt said, "I kept cursing in check when my daughter was young, but now the curses fly." So there's a question there of when we tell our kids not to curse, or we don't curse around our kids so that they won't curse, are we doing something to benefit them, or is it just to spare ourselves the embarrassment of them using the word in front of someone else and then someone judging us for their use of the word? So is it actually helpful to prevent your kids from cursing? And I think you're going to say maybe not.
Well, you know, as a parent of several younger children myself, I have had the experience many times of telling them not to do things, which they then go ahead directly and do in order to. I think that's generally the lesson that we get. you know, there are lots of things that we teach kids to do in certain contexts only, right? That's a large part of our socialization of kids is, well, okay, this behavior is appropriate here, but when we go to grandma's house, then you have to eat, you actually have to eat your spaghetti with a fork and not with your bare hands. profanity is just like that, right? That your teacher isn't going to like it if you say this. Your rabbi isn't going to like it if you say this. But it's okay to say at home in the ways that we use it at home. That seems to me like exactly in line with lots of the other sorts of things that kids are able to do from a very early age. Prohibitions. Certainly there are some bright red lines involving using slurs towards other people and so on. And the nice thing about that is that, like we were saying earlier, those words are actually meant to harm other people. And you can bundle that into a much larger lesson about, well, we just don't want to harm other people. We don't want to hurt other people. And so this is the language that goes along with not throwing rocks at people and hitting people with sticks.
So I could drop F-bombs around my kid. Is that what you're saying? It's perfectly fine. It's not going to harm them in the long term?
Well, there's no evidence of direct harm. Like, there's no evidence that it leads to desensitization to taboo concepts, or that it leads to them being more aggressive.
They're not a bigger jerk in the long run, basically.
Right.
Yeah. You're going to have to teach them how to code switch depending on the audience. Thank you so much for talking to us. That is Ben Bergen, author of What the F. We've been talking about use of swear words and the changing culture around profane language. Thank you so much for being on Studio 2.
Hey, it's been a lot of fun.
Coming up next, NPR Weekend Edition host Aisha Roscoe on the importance of HBCUs and how a black university shaped her. That's coming up, I promise, on Studio 2. That was a good flipping segment.
That was great. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Most HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities, were founded during racial segregation when black students were barred from many schools. But today, despite all the school choices, many HBCUs are seeing record enrollment. Cherry, you attended an HBCU, right?
Yes, I did. My law degree is from Howard University, and some of the best years of my life were there. The culture of excellence, the history, and just the example of service that fuels my work today, even as a journalist. Well, Aisha Roscoe, who listeners know as the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday, Up First, and a former White House correspondent, she also went to an HBCU, Avi, and she edited a new collection of essays by famous HBCU alum, folks like Oprah Winfrey, Stacey Abrams, and comedian Roy Wood Jr. The book is called HBCU Made, and I spoke to Roscoe about why black schools are still so relevant and how her undergraduate experience helped launch her career. So, Aisha, you're a Howard Bison. I am as well.
And oh, awesome.
Yeah, so I want to start our conversation by you telling us a bit of your HBCU story, because I read for you there was only one HBCU.
There was only one HBCU for me, and I know for other people, I didn't want to offend anyone, but for me, you know, Howard was the Mecca. It was the one that had the name recognition, it was just this special place. And I felt like if I could go to Howard in the big city of DC, to me, because I'm a Durham, North Carolina girl, if I could go to Howard and make it, I could make it anywhere. That's where I wanted to go, to see if I could survive, to see if I could make it. And I'm really grateful that I did go.
You didn't just survive, you thrived there.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. You became editor-in-chief of The Hilltop.
Yes. At the time, the Hilltop was daily. It was the only daily Black college newspaper at that time, and really one of the only Black daily newspapers in the country. And, you know, look, we were we were in over our heads, but we made it happen. And we put that paper out every day. And I still didn't have a lot of confidence in myself, even though I was editor in chief. So part of what I talk about in the essay is like learning how to enjoy the moment and not worry so much about whether you can do it when you can realize you are doing it, right? I was so worried about whether it was possible. I missed that it was already happening and I just needed to enjoy it.
Yeah. What did going to an HBCU do to change you into the person you are today?
It gave me a measure of confidence that I definitely didn't have before. And it also gave me a sense of context. And it made me understand that, you know, Black people are part of every subject, every industry, every, you know, in ways that I had never known before. I mean, because every class at, you know, Howard, whether it was math, whether it was classics or anything, you would learn about Black people in a very natural way. And like how Black people, because Black people are a part of the world, mm-hmm. and you realize like, oh, we're a part of all this. We're not like a special month. You know, Howard is a school, and I think many HBCUs are like this, where, you know, you're pushed for excellence.
Yes.
You're pushed to be the absolute best. And you see all of these people that came before you, whether it's, you know, Toni Morrison, or Thurgood Marshall or Felicia Rashad and so on and so forth, who've done like all of these amazing things. I think that what I took from that was the idea of not that I would be exactly like them, but there could be something where people might know Aisha Roscoe for who she is. Mm. And maybe there was something within me that was worthy of it. I can see now in the work that I do that the seeds that were planted at Howard are now bearing fruit all these many years later.
I got to read a little excerpt from your intro. You say, I'm always cognizant of the many ways in which Black leaders, Black institutions, and other marginalized groups have been mistreated by the media. Yet I do not believe that love and loyalty require silence in the face of harmful actions and policies. You learned this philosophy through your work at the Hilltop. Can you tell us the story of how you developed that philosophy?
Well, I think, you know, being a journalist and, you know, even a young journalist, you're not a PR person. You're not a fluff person. You're always the person who's trying to shine a light on things. You're trying to, you know, let people know what's going on. And that's not always positive. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to bump up against those who work in PR. And in my case, it was the people who worked in comms for the university, who felt like, you know, and well, and their job was to protect the reputation of the institution. That's their job. But that was not my job as a journalist. And so sometimes they would feel like, why are you airing our dirty laundry? Why are you putting these stories about crime or this fire that happened or this, you know, this negative thing, this lawsuit against an administrator? I would push back on that. I didn't give in. And because what I felt like was, you know, look, I love Howard, but loving something means wanting it to be the best that it can be. A legacy is something to live up to. It's not something to coast on. And that's what I developed during that time at Howard.
And you are now, you know, a Black woman with a very unique voice. People have talked about that. You've talked yeah. about that. How did that confidence you learned in the HBCU help you stand in who you are and not change it?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I didn't come from a broadcast background. So that mm-hmm. helped a bit because I didn't have any specific training to tell me this is what you're supposed to sound. And when I came in, everyone said you should sound like yourself. And I believed them. I was like, okay, well, let me just sound like the best version of me. I think that what gave me the confidence partly was that NPR itself, like no one at NPR was like, you know, you need to change this. You need to sound yeah. differently. So that gave me confidence. When people started reacting to me, and especially over time, at first it was a little like, what are they talking about? I didn't get it. But then as they would, you know, keep going, oh, you're an affirmative action hire, or why do you talk so ghetto, you're talking street talk or whatever. I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm talking about the president. I'm not talking like, but going to Howard, going to HBCU, I began to understand what they were responding to was not the specific words that I was saying, but they were responding to hearing someone in a voice of authority who they did not think should be a voice of authority, mm-hmm. right? They were not used to hearing someone who sounds like me delivering the news, not just about Black people, but about the entire world. And to them, it was like this was an affront, right? And so what I was able to do because of the context and the things that I had learned was to understand that, oh, this isn't really about me, right? This is about a society in which the only people who've been allowed to speak and be heard and respected have had to sound a certain way. And that is not like a Black woman from the South. People now who hear me on the radio, hopefully maybe some young child is hearing me, they'll grow up and they'll think this is normal. This is what authority sounds like. So if I can expand that universe, then I'm happy to do it.
Yeah. And I got to ask you about this book. You talked about some of the folks in the highest echelons of America and beyond. You got to put together a wonderful group of people who shared their HBCU experiences. You have Oprah Winfrey in you, in this book, Stacey Abrams, Brandon Marsalis. You have April Ryan, so many people. What was it like putting this group of essays together?
You know, it was really incredible. You know, I'm so grateful to every single person that contributed to the book. It was a work of love, a labor of love. You know, it took a lot of begging and pleading, but I'm so happy that we were able to bring, it was really important because I wanted to bring people from different generations. You know, I wanted the bigger schools represented. So, you know, the FAMUs, mm-hmm. the Howards, the Spelmans, but I also wanted the smaller schools, you know, so Morgan State, Dillard, Talladega, because there is a wide range. I wanted people with a wide variety of backgrounds. And you know, as always, I like to say, this is a small slice of it. No one book could capture the entire HBCU experience. There are 100 HBCUs. And so this is just a small testimony to it. But I'm so happy that we've been able to do the people that we were able to get to contribute.
Yeah. And as we wrap up, I know when you think back, you prayed to the Lord.
Yes, I did pray to the Lord.
About, do I go to Howard? What do I do, Lord? Yes. And I just laughed because you said at a certain point, you just got to make a decision. And
you got to
like,
make a decision.
I'm going to do it. And if I come home in a dumpster, it is what it is.
But
but it transformed your life. So when you look back to that time, when you made that decision, it feels like you knew exactly where you needed to be.
I did. And I think that I was scared of, you know, I was scared of making the wrong decision, but I think I was also scared of, was I all that I thought I could be? Like, I felt like I could make it, but is that really true? Am I really good enough? Can I really make it? And sometimes you really have to like quiet that internal hater and say, no, you can make it. You can do it. And that gave me the confidence to chase my dreams. And I'm so glad that I made that decision.
And that was NPR Weekend Edition Sunday host Aisha Roscoe talking about her new book, HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience. And I will never forget my 3 years, I'll tell you that, at Howard. And Howard is different. I'm going to always rep Howard.
Howard is different.
Bison, yes.
Bison. I will never forget that particular pronunciation of the word bison.
Yes. And, you know, it's this rivalry between Howard University and Hampton University. And we say we're the real HU. It's like a whole thing.
But I'm with you now. Boo Hampton.
Yeah, boo Hampton.
Sorry, Hampton.
That's right, Avi. Get on board. That's right. Get on board.
I'm waving my pennant over here. Go
That's
Bison.
Right.
And that is it for our show today. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Adam Staniszewski is our engineer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.